Wednesday night edition of the pod tonight. Got a lot to get to. Most importantly, we want to talk about whether some of these surprise teams so far are for real. Few teams of surprise, like Indiana with a great win on the road in Cleveland tonight. At least it used to be a great win. I don't know whether it still counts anymore with the Cavs in their current state, but we'll talk a little bit about that game. Talk about Orlando, a surprise team as well, winning at Memphis. Danny was able to catch some of that one. Those same Memphis Grizzlies as well, we're going to talk about as whether they are for real. With the, they've had some great wins as well. Detroit, after they beat the Clippers and Golden State on a back-to-back on a West Coast trip, did lose then to the Lakers the other night, but they are 5-3. And then Boston, a team that we really feared for after the Gordon Hayward injury, now 6-1 since opening night. We're sponsored today by Stamps.com. Use that cap space code and you can take advantage of their special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Good evening, my friend, here at 12:03 a.m. on the West Coast. And for once, actually, it was your fault that we're starting so late instead of me.
Yeah, I mean, for a couple of different reasons, it was my fault. I mean, you were nice enough to come to the first book signing for my book, which was I much appreciated. It was a lot of fun. Great to do that. And also, I was a little bit later doing this because I actually took a very brief nap before we got going. And this was it was kind of an interesting night of basketball because we had planned to do Are They For Real before I even really thought about how many of those teams were in action tonight.
Yeah, and sadly it wasn't time to panic because the Cavs would certainly be discussed in that one. Let's get some news real quick here first. Not a ton, but Jahlil Okafor saying in the media that he wants a buyout. Keith Pompey saying perhaps the Celtics might be interested in him, and Okafor basically repeating the contents of his conversation with Brian Colangelo. Colangelo said, yeah, you know, we can't just give you away for free though. And so it seems like really, because to me at this point, Okafor making that $5 million salary, it probably would be better if they had just given him away for free, because then they could use that extra money to renegotiate and extend Robert Covington. So, you know, I mean, what do you think the Sixers have been asking for? I mean, clearly they're asking for a lot around this time last year, but now that it's gotten to the point, especially where his option has been declined, I mean, who's going to trade for him? I mean, thinking, because no team that like wants to win this year is going to trade for Okafor, right? You're doing it as a value play to try to get him up to speed offensively and then hope that his defense can improve. But he's not going to be a positive player for a winning team this season. It's more, he's more of a prospect type of guy. And so, I mean, are they holding out for like an okay second round pick? Do they still want a first? They're not getting that. I don't even think they're going to get an okay second. So at this point, I would just give him his wish and either trade him for nothing or release him if he's, maybe this is just trying to strong arm him so he'll give more money back in the buyout.
It could very well be that. And once you've made it this far without getting an offer that's to your liking, that means whether or not your asking price was too high, I think they should be ready to move on. And you brought up the point about having more money to pay Robert Covington. That is certainly true. However, that could also be motivation for him to come to a deal in terms of just him giving back a little bit of his salary, because you probably don't want to burn that whole $5 million on Covington, because only 40% of that can be reduced in future years for specifically for 2018 when they want to do space.
They could get creative there too.
Sure. I mean,
we were talking about this a little bit on our G-chat. Sorry, like maybe what you do is you give him more money and over 3 years, and then you make the fourth year non-guaranteed. You know, you could do something along those lines to where you have so much more flexibility if you can throw an extra $6 million, $5 million bucks onto that bonus payment this year, essentially. So, but I mean, I feel like they're being a little bit unfair to Okafor at this point. Do you feel that way?
I absolutely do. And especially because they're not giving him any time. I mean, even right now with Rashawn Holmes being out, basically it took Embiid also not playing for Okafor to even get on the floor. So it's hard to expect that his value is going to get any higher. And now teams know that the Sixers do not have much in leverage. And this, you know, when you consider that Nerlens Noel was a much better player when they traded him, and really what they got back was fairly hollow. I mean, they did get back a decent second from the Mavericks in that deal. But Okafor's value is so much lower right now, and they don't need him. So why are they holding out for something they're never going to get?
Well, and it's not like they didn't learn their lesson at like how much lower his trade value has gotten the longer they wait. I mean, and now they've declined his option. Really, I think his trade value potentially is even lower, and they declined that option because they didn't want to be stuck with him for next season with a guaranteed contract. But that also reduced his trade value. But when another team could have traded for him and exercised the option, they chose not to do so. So clearly there isn't a team that values him enough to trade for him. And to decline the option, it's like either trade him or let him go before you have to decline the option. Now he's worth even less in a trade. And he made the point, and he's, I think he's absolutely correct that, you know, they think they're getting something, and John, his agent, are like, and it's funny when a player would say this, but they're like, I'm not worth anything in a trade right now. It's basically what he said. Like, they got to get it through their thick skulls that I'm not worth anything in a trade right now, and just let me go.
One thing that I've noticed in some of the reporting that's been out there has been discussion about Boston being a team that he could go to, partially because they've been interested in him in the past, and they do have that money, which they theoretically could use for the disabled player exception, or they could just get him for the minimum if he gets bought out. But Boston has an overstuffed rotation. If I were him, unless they make some sort of commitment, which I would be very surprised to see Danny Ainge do considering all the circumstances here, I would be looking more for a team that had minutes to burn than anything else, because even if a team is committed to you, they've already started to establish their rotations and everything like that.
If you could pick the team to go to, if you were him, who would it be?
Brooklyn.
Just you could, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's right. Brooklyn, it seems, especially because they are interested in developing guys. They don't really care about defense that much. He could run a lot of pick and roll with D'Angelo Russell. That'd be hilarious if the two guys 2 years later that they're trying to decide, the Lakers are trying to decide between in the 2015 draft, both ended up on the Nets. But yeah, I think that seems right. Phoenix might be another one, but Phoenix really, I think, has more mouths to feed than Brooklyn does necessarily.
Well, and especially if they're going to dabble with Dragan Bender playing the five, you know, they have guys that have stock. Whereas, especially, you know, if Jared Allen, whenever he's missing time, Brooklyn is just basically trying to find guys that can work. So Ja is totally fine to be there.
Yeah. But other than that, really not a ton of options. So you want to talk about tonight's games a little bit, and then maybe we can use them as a prism to transition into our discussion topic today of whether some of these surprise teams are for real.
Well, one thing that is for real is Cleveland struggles defending the pick and roll. I mean, I thought that was my biggest takeaway for the portions of Indiana Cleveland that I watched was, yes, full credit, Sabonis has looked a lot better this year than before, and Collison has had a few nice games too, but Cleveland made those guys, and to a lesser extent, a lot of the other players on the Pacers, look absolutely fantastic offensively in this game.
Yeah, it's just, where's the defense going to come from now, right? Tristan Thompson only played 15 minutes, then suffered a calf strain and left the arena on crutches. You have to imagine it'll be at least a couple of weeks before he is able to return. The biggest thing that worries me, people have been talking about the Cleveland defense, and yeah, you know, it's not great in the regular season, and there's no reason they should be that much worse than last year other than everyone just kind of being a year older and a year lazier and playing more of Love at center as well. I'm more concerned about the Cavaliers offense, because even when their defense was so bad last year, they still were able to light teams up. And this is another awful three-point shooting game on the season. They're about 34%, which is not as bad as I anticipated, but every game that I watch them, they shoot terribly. 7 out of 31 in this one. J.R. Smith is shooting 17% from three, even in a starting role. Rose doesn't take any threes. Wade doesn't take any threes. Jay Crowder missed all five of his three-point attempts today. LeBron is really the only guy shooting well from three. He's at 40%, and Korver obviously too. He's over 50% so far this year. So they don't really have that explosiveness. They don't just feel like there's this overwhelming tide of three-pointer after three-pointer waiting to come, even though James was excellent in this game with 33 points on 14 to 22 and 11 assists. You just didn't really get that feeling that the dam is about to break, as you do in so many of these Cavs games.
To your point, the Cavs are only scoring 106 points per 100 possessions with LeBron on the floor, and LeBron has been very good this year overall by himself. I mean,
yeah, although he did just have two games in a row under 20 points, which I think has only happened like 20 times or so in his career, the Pacers broadcast was saying, and he's coming off that ankle injury, not going to be as effective. He had 8 turnovers this one too. And I think a lot of that is due to the lack of spacing.
But where I wanted to go with the 106 is, it's early in the season, but a 106 offensive rating is not particularly dominant. That would have been last year, would have been league average just about. And if their defense is not going to be elite, the way they're going to win games, even in the playoffs, is going to be scoring a ton and then having enough defense to win. It's not going to be the other way around.
No, I think that's right. There was one sequence in the fourth quarter that really got my eyes up was LeBron and Wade were both basically in a two-guard front, essentially, and they had shooters around in the corners. So LeBron tried to drive from the right wing, and Dwayne Wade's guy gapped off of him and forced LeBron to pass it to Wade. Then that guy closed out because Wade wasn't going to shoot the three. Wade then tried to drive past him. LeBron's guy then gapped off of Wade and forced him to pass it back to LeBron. LeBron passed up the shot, tried to drive, passed it back to Wade again after his guy gapped off him, and Wade had to force up an impossible three-pointer. And it was just a perfect encapsulation of how the lack of spacing on the team. And Rose had another nice game, 9-13, but didn't get to the foul line, didn't shoot any three-point attempts. You know, even when he shoots 9-13, he only had 19 points. So he also is hurting his teammates when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. He's had one assist tonight. He's averaging like 1.5 assists a game. So the effect that all these guys are having, and then just that they're not really playing the same way. Kevin Love was not good in this one, only 4 out of 12, just wasn't really that engaged in the offense either. Jay Crowder couldn't hit a shot. There just wasn't really anywhere that they could go other than just LeBron trying to go through to the rim. And then when they didn't pack the paint against him, he was able to score because they have no rim protection, and they don't really have anyone his size to guard him. But other than that, they didn't really have any kind of an offensive flow in this game, and they haven't really all year.
On the opposite side of that, I mean, while they're not going to shoot 16 to 26 from three every game, nobody is. Indiana, you know, the way, not only just in terms of the shots they were getting, but the way their offense was moving, it looked a lot more natural. And we gave a little bit of credit to Frank Vogel, I can't remember which podcast that was, about how the Magic were playing a different style than we thought he was comfortable with. I think we should give the same credit or similar credit into his former team.
Yeah, there was talk that they wanted to push the ball. Now, remember, with Nate McMillan, he had played very slow ISO offenses, which were good offenses many a time in Seattle and in Portland. But they really have gotten up tempo this year. Easier to do that against the Cavs' porous transition defense, but really, and they played against the Nets too, who are another speeded up team. But what really impressed me more than that, and they were doing some basic stuff, they just ran high pick and roll a lot with Oladipo over and over again in the fourth quarter, and he was on fire. But I think Sabonis has really impressed me as a center, and everything we talked about, the lack of flow for the Cavs, everything really flows well for the Pacers when Sabonis is in there. He's always moving the ball somewhere, doing something, making a quick decision, knows where to throw it. I mean, there are a few plays that were instructive. One was Oladipo was late in the shot clock, and Sabonis ran up to set the screen for him, and there's just going to be a boring pick and roll that probably would have led to a trap. LeBron was on him, and then Sabonis called for the ball, Oladipo threw it to him, and then Oladipo cut hard and really got up more speed than he could with the dribble, got it right back for a dribble pitch, and was able to elude LeBron and hit a three. Another time, Sabonis was in the middle on a fast break, the ball came to him from the left side, and he just instantly found Darren Collison in the corner for a three, and Collison was absolutely ridiculous in this game with 25 points on only 10 shot attempts from the field. It hit all three of his three-pointers and had 8 assists, so he was fantastic. And as a role guy, he makes great decisions, either goes to his floater game or he'll move it immediately to the weak side. He'll find Thad Young working around on the baseline. It's just the fact that he's always moving, always moves the ball, makes a quick decision, and then, you know, you're not forcing him to post up now, so he's the whole Zoolander thing, which still exists, by the way, he only goes to his left hand, isn't as much of a problem. He can hit floaters in the lane, he can catch it and finish, especially against a team that doesn't have shot blockers like the Cavs. And I really was just extremely impressed, and then he's an excellent rebounder, had 6 assists in this game as well.
This can kind of be a transition into the are they for real, but something that intrigued me going through the stats on them is that Sabonis is allowing, so a 47.4% field goal percentage on defended shots at the rim so far this year, and that seems to me like a little bit of an outlier. I don't think he's going to be that far into it, and of course we're super young in the season, 7 games in, but if he can stay anywhere close to that, especially if he's a backup and so he'll be facing its worst people when Miles Turner gets back in there, you can live with that defensively with him at center.
Yeah, the other guy who impressed me, before we get in talking about them just overall here, was Oladipo. Just what he was able to do in high pick and roll, he really showed the creativity off the dribble that has been lacking for him. And then the 5 of 7 on threes that he hit, he got going in the third quarter with a couple of defensive mistakes by Cleveland that were Crowder and J.R. Smith. Crowder started the second half for Tristan Thompson after he suffered that calf injury, just blew a switch and Oladipo was wide open for a three on the left wing, and that seemed to get him going. But he had one move where he off the pick and roll showed some great hesitation. He's done a great job of finding Sabonis. Another thing Sabonis is great at is just knowing when to slip the screen and when to set the screen, and he's always able to create a passing angle for even someone like Oladipo, who's not been the greatest passer so far in his career. They're always able to either find Sabonis or use his grab gravity and let Oladipo get to the rim. But he had a lot of nice plays just off the dribble, showing advanced moves, handling it. And while he's not a great passer to throw it to the weak side, he's able to just throw it to Sabonis and then let Sabonis move it along on kind of more of a short roll type of play. And as long as Oladipo's shot is going down, he's now scored over 20 points in 6 of his 8 games as a Pacer. You know, maybe he and Sabonis are going to make that trade look better than we thought it was at the time. I'm not ready to jump on that bandwagon yet, but I think both of them have looked better than I thought they would look at any point this season so far.
That's fair, and I wonder how they're going to use Sabonis when they get Miles Turner back, because Turner is still absolutely the alpha and the omega in terms of the center position for them. I don't think, even though I've liked what they've gotten from Sabonis and how he's made their team better, it hasn't made you rethink Turner at all, has it?
No, it hasn't, although I do think that perhaps Sabonis is much less effective as a four. I mean, he really needs to be the guy who is getting the screen and doing the DHOs. Turner, not as mobile, not as good of a passer, not as good of a decision maker, not even really necessarily as good of a finisher on the move going towards the basket. Now, Turner is excellent in pick and pop, and of course, his defensive abilities are far superior to what we've seen from Sabonis. Although I think their rebounding may also be hurt. Actually, Sabonis is a better rebounder on defensive glass than Turner. So Turner is a better player, better prospect, but it wouldn't shock me if there's an adjustment period now because everyone has really gotten so comfortable with Sabonis at 37 minutes tonight. And we also would be remiss in not discussing Thaddeus Young, who is shooting the lights out right now, just looking very comfortable, taking so many more threes a game, 4 threes a game, and he had 26 tonight as well. And like pretty much everyone on the Pacers, shot 50% or more three-pointer.
Thaddeus Young has now had 4 consecutive games making at least 2 three-pointers. That's really impressive when you consider where he was even a few years ago to be at that level. And each of those games, he shot 40% or better from three.
All right, we'll get to tonight's other game that we wanted to do and talk about some of these teams in a moment. But first, this from Stamps.com. Going to the post office could be such a drag. Lines are long. It's always out of the way. That's why Danny, who's been doing a ton of mailing stuff, you've been using Stamps.com quite a bit lately.
I have been. When you write a book, when you start getting the physical copies, you get really excited at the beginning. It's like, oh my God, I wrote this and it's in front of you. But then you realize, oh, I have so many of these to send to people. And that is daunting for a couple different reasons. And I had actually never used Stamps.com with any regularity before this. I was aware of it as a product, but you know, I was always okay with the post office. I would go sporadically enough. And fortunately, the ones around me aren't completely insane, but it's so much more convenient. I became a convert on that first day when I was printing out labels from my computer, and you can arrange a delivery, which is absolutely huge. So what be
a pickup.
Yeah. Pickup is,
I did that just the other day, actually, as well.
It's fantastic. So it takes the parts of the that are so much more stressful. And what I've been using for the book project is media mail. You can do media mail. It's sending books like I'm doing, and it's cheaper, and you can do that through stamps.com, and it's cheaper through stamps.com.
Yeah, they bring all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. As you mentioned, you can get discounts there that you can't even get at the post office. You too can enjoy stamps.com if you have a business, especially. You're probably going to use it even more than Danny and I do. They're offering a special deal, including a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitment. The way to get started with them, go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of their homepage, type in my code CAPSPACE so that you let them know that you came from us. That's stamps.com. Enter that code CAPSPACE, which of course we talk about all the time in the program. It's even on the back of our t-shirt. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. So let's talk about Indiana here real quickly, just in general, whether they're going to be able to keep this up. And what I like to look at statistically about these teams, I mean, obviously it's good to just look at how guys look better. I think actually by the eye test, maybe they look a little bit better than they do statistically with what Oladipo has done, what Sabonis has been able to do, Thad Young looking much more comfortable out there as well. But I mean, the first thing you want to look at is their point differential way worse than their record? Are they just getting lucky in close games? It's a little early to be looking at that even. The other thing I like to look at is three-point shooting, right? And Ben Falk wrote a great article about the Magic, which hit on some of the same themes in much greater detail, of course, that we talked about with the Magic a couple nights ago with their three-point shooting. And what he found is that basically at this point in the season, the percentage that you shoot from three and that your opponent shoot from three basically means absolutely nothing as far as what percentage you're going to shoot for the rest of the season. It really, you have to get a much larger sample size for players, for teams. That's really what's important there. So if you don't really have a history as a good three-point shooting team and you're shooting it really well, especially, you have to expect that's going to regress at least back back to average, if not perhaps even more than that. And then defensively, if you're just getting lucky with a bunch of missed threes, you know, it's really much more important to look at just where the shots are being given up and how often, as a predictor defensively in particular. Another thing you can look at is similar stuff on mid-range jump shots, right? Jump shots have a lot more variation than shots at the rim. If you think about it, shots at the rim are kind of more talent-based, in some ways less subject to luck, although you still can get lucky on those sorts of plays too. And then another thing I like to look at as well is if they're allowing very few points per possession in transition, teams don't really have that much control over the opposing team's points per possession in transition, because generally if you're giving up a shot in the first 7 seconds or so of the shot clock, it's a good shot for the opponent. And really, again, it's about taking away those opportunities. Like if they've found a shot that they can take, you're not going to be like, oh yeah, we're so good at stopping these transition layups once they get to the rim, or so good at forcing them to miss transition threes. It's more about just keeping them out of transition to begin with. And so if teams are just at the bottom of the league in points per possession in transition, you generally should expect that to just revert back to the league average.
Can I give one example of that? This is pretty amazing. So the Clippers right now, according to Quentin the Glass, are giving up the highest proportion of opponents' shots in transition and the lowest points per play. So when you look at that, you go, oh, well, that's going to be a problem potentially long term. They're giving up less than a point per possession in transition. But opponents have 22.4%. So that's like the double warning sign. I will caution too on those numbers
are a little fluky, sure, especially with this new stat system that the NBA has, where the timing on rebounds, they're doing a good job of putting that in. So it's kind of hard to calculate that. But you also can look at the play type numbers from Synergy, which are on NBA.com, which we cross-reference with. And those are actually logged by humans as to whether it's transition or not. Usually a slightly higher percentage of transition is logged just by the stat sheet as opposed to like the human saying what transition is. And you can always have a different approach there as far as what you think is transition, what you don't. I mean, the whole fast break points, the NBA, I think, is way too stingy in determining what a fast break point is compared to what we would kind of think of as transition, where basically the fact that you got beat down the court quickly could even lead, you know, 2 or 3 passes later to a shot. At least in my opinion, you still say, hey, the root cause of this was, you know, the fact that it started off in transition. So with all that in mind, let's talk about Indiana first here. They have a top 5 offense, and mostly that is through shooting the ball extremely well. They are 19th in defense and 22nd in field goal defense, so it's not like they're getting lucky there, but they haven't been particularly unlucky either. I mean, I would expect with this defensive personnel, maybe when Turner comes back, he can make a difference, but especially with their wing guys, Sabonis is not really a good defender if he's going to play some center as well. So don't expect their defense to get much better. They really have some guys who are shooting lights out right now, and that's maybe an indication that they could be due for somewhat of a regression off.
Yeah, I mean, Victor Oladipo is 21 of 42 from three. That's a pretty ridiculous number. Corey Joseph, 11 of 19. And something else that's fascinating with them is that they're shooting 35% from three, but the proportion of their shots that are coming from distance is actually on the lower side of the NBA.
Yeah, and by the way, some of these stats are from before they lit it up to the tune of that 16 of 26 today. But yeah, I mean, they're not taking a ton of threes. They are sixth in field goal attempts at the rim, and they are pretty decent on the offensive glass, pretty decent avoiding turnovers. They're right around 10th in getting to the foul line as well. So those factors are there. It's just a question of whether the shooting is going to keep up to quite this level, and I don't expect it will. I mean, it's really how Turner is going to affect things, whether Oladipo, whether Sabonis can keep that up as they become more of a focus. Darren Collison is having a wonderful start to the season as well. Joseph shooting far above his career norm. Also Young shooting above his career norms. I mean, it's hard to imagine that all of these guys can keep playing so much better, that there's something magic in the water, that they're suddenly going to be this good, but maybe playing at a faster pace is part of that. And they've banked a few wins here as well, and they've beaten a couple of good teams. Anything else that we wanted to say is just kind of data here before we maybe revise our prediction for what we thought they were going to be?
No, not really. I think that's all we really, I mean, especially because we talked about their game today, so we can kind of roll from there. Do you want me to start?
Okay, so, well, no. So, yeah, what was your preseason prediction for the Indiana preseason?
I don't remember exactly, but I remember I was more optimistic on them than you. I think it was like low 30s. I think I was like 33 or something like that.
I think you actually, as I recall, went over on them.
I did.
Went under. You're certainly looking better there. For my part, we did their podcast ago. So you had 33 wins. I had 31. Would you like to revise that prediction at all based on what has occurred?
It could go up to like 35, 36. I mean, they could be better than that. Currently, 538 has them projected to go 41-41, but I think that's a little bit too rosy. And then you also have to assume, you know, injury. They have had, you know, Miles Turner, of course, but you have to assume that that'll hit them just like it'll hit anybody else. So you just add a little bit of caution to it because you're not going to get better due to, you know, unless you're Sterling healthy and everybody else is hurt.
Yeah, I mean, simply the fact that they've started 5-3 and you would expect them to have gone 2-6 or 3-5 based on what we thought their record to be, you know, you probably got to add a couple of wins to the ledger just based on that. Yeah, I mean, I think I could bump them up to 36 or 37 wins. And if they keep this going for another 2 weeks, then, you know, I think I'll seriously revise my prediction. But yeah, I think like so many of these guys are just so far over their previous norms that 8 games just isn't quite enough for me to say, hey, you know, this is the new level for these guys.
I like to think about this not necessarily in terms of wins, but in terms of tiers. And I do think that they've moved to me into that like serious potential to make the playoff kind of an area. Like they're not anywhere close to the lock area yet. You know, they're probably 5-6 or so teams in that range, but they have moved into the area where like it wouldn't surprise me if they could make the playoffs this year, especially with teams like the Sixers, you know, scuttling a little bit. They did win again today, but you know, like I wouldn't be for it. Like if somebody were to come back and say, hey, the Pacers made the playoffs, I'd be like, okay, you know, that's good for them, not completely ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think we did say, hey, maybe this team could be, you know, the 10th best team in the East. So and the East not looking too pathetic, actually a winning record against the Western Conference so far. Let's talk about this Orlando Memphis game. I didn't see any of it, so I will let you take it away and maybe I'll ask you some questions.
What I focused on in this one, because we're watching it after the fact, was the fourth quarter, because it was weird to watch this game knowing what happened, because you're sitting there going, how can Memphis be this competitive without Mike Conley being in the game? He did not play due to the Achilles injury, which freaked us out on the last episode of Dunked On. Ended up not playing. Mario Chalmers played in his stead, and the guy who was the star for their offense, other than Marcus Ole, had some really nice plays, including a huge bucket late, was Tyreke Evans. Evans was able to get to the basket regularly, which is such an important part of his game. And their defense was, you know, it was stout. It wasn't perfect. There were some plays down the stretch where Orlando just messed up. And one of the other big stories in this game was Orlando just kicking the ball all over the place. They had 24 turnovers in this game, which allowed Memphis to shoot the ball 7 more times. And that ended up being a part of this game, but Orlando still ended up winning. The big shot overall was Aaron Gordon. So I talked about how their offense looked disjointed for most of the fourth quarter. I think that it did. But they got a nice drive for Evan Fournier, and Gasol was on Aaron Gordon. Gasol went to the rim to help out, and Gordon just buried a corner three, which put Orlando up. And while Memphis got 2 chances to take the lead and probably win the game, they missed both of those. And so Orlando came away with another nice victory.
Yeah, this is an interesting matchup. Orlando has been outstanding in transition so far. Memphis, one of the best teams at preventing transition opportunities. Who won that battle in this?
I think that overall, Memphis did a good job of controlling that. When you saw, there were some opportunities for Orlando to drive, but it definitely wasn't the feast that they've had in some of their other games this year. Even going back to, I think that was the game against Cleveland, where they just got a bunch of opportunities in transition.
Yeah, getting back to Evan, it looked like he basically was 4-6 from 3, which you don't expect to continue for him. Didn't really get to the foul line at all, but took a ton of shots at the rim. And I would imagine a big part of his success, like he's always been able to get to the rim, even through all the injuries, but he just can't make layups. But Orlando is a nice panacea with Nikola Vucevic in there for making a lot of layups. You have to imagine that was a big part of it.
It was. And one of the stats, because I compiled the stuff for Is Memphis For Real, was that Tyreke Evans before this game was in the 95th percentile in terms of the relative to his position, relative to the proportion of shots at the rim, but he was only making 45% there. So that is a big concern. And it is substantially easier to do that against Orlando than other teams. So it was a linchpin for their offense in this game without Mike Conley there. And something else that was weird to me was just that at the very end of the game, they brought Chalmers back in and they went away from Tyreke. And it was strange to me because I'd been watching, you know, I didn't have the full context of the game, but I had the full context of that quarter. And that was where they were getting their offense. It wasn't like Orlando changed the personnel, so you thought Tyreke wasn't going to get there. They were just relying on Chalmers, and Chalmers wasn't getting as much. And Chalmers actually, I thought, on the second to last possession, botched it. And he had an open three and he took it, but he's still not the greatest 3-point shooter. And they weren't behind behind by three, it wasn't a circumstance where that's exactly what they needed. I thought they could have fought for something better.
Oh, I can't comment on that one because I didn't see the shot. But what I can comment on is enjoy, savor this moment, Memphis fans. Andrew Harrison actually shot 50% in this game, who's 4 of 8 field.
Yeah, I mean, you have a bunch of these just kind of players on Memphis and you're kind of seeing what they do. Dylan Brooks played 37 minutes off the bench. Like that's kind of the reverse Bogans, I guess. And he looked good out there in the fourth quarter. He had a couple nice cuts. He had one big corner three. And the hope is that they won't have to rely on him as heavily as they have. He has had some nice good performances. But really what Memphis is looking for long term is just having a bunch of these options, you know, getting more from Seldon. So maybe, but I think the player who could actually, they could benefit from excising, as you said, is Harrison. I think that swapping him out for Seldon and McLemore could end up being really helpful for them.
Yeah, and we'll see too. I mean, Chalmers has really struggled field so far. But that said, Memphis really has been winning on the strength of dominating bench performances so far this year. And frankly, I gotta say, I mean, it's not like these guys are like world beaters, you know, and they have long struggled with their bench units. So I'm not ready to say that like this 13.5 bench net rating is necessarily going to continue.
Or that 90.1 defensive rating for their bench. Yeah, I don't exactly expect that to continue.
Yeah, so we mentioned that they're really good at getting back on D. That's long been something that they've been really good at, especially because Mark now doesn't spend as much time near the rim. He's not really an offensive rebounder. He can get back. And I've always felt that getting your bigs back is one of the keys to transition defense.
Well, that gets into something that I think is really the centerpiece of their success so far this year. They're fourth in defense, 22nd in offense, is that they're number two in terms of the opponent proportion of possessions in the half court. And that's huge for them because their half court defense has been great. They're fourth in opponent points per possession there. So they're forcing the team, the other team to play in an area that they're very comfortable with. But it is worth noting that, albeit with different personnel to a degree last year, they were kind of middle of the road in terms of the proportion element of this. Some of that you could say is attributable to not having Zebo on their team this year. And, you know, they're younger and more athletic broadly on the perimeter. I mean, Ennis playing more, I think, has definitely been a good thing. And it's not like Vince was bad defensively last year, but you have a little bit more there. And so if one of your kind of scheme goals is to get back a little bit more, then they certainly have personnel that can handle that.
Another worry for them is the fact that they're giving up a lot of threes and opponents just aren't shooting a good percentage on it. The fact that they're giving up a lot of threes is much more worrisome to me than the percentage, obviously, as we talked about, would basically mean nothing at this point of the year.
Oh yeah, there are a ton of warning signs in terms of the shots that opponents are getting against them. So basically, they're not forcing many shots in the mid-range. They're in the bottom 10 and forcing a proportion of the mid-range, and they're in the top 10 in terms of allowing three-pointers. And so that's usually a really rough way to go at it. They're doing a decent job of preventing shots at the rim, and then they've been absolutely great in terms of field goal percentage at the rim. And that's something where, you know, they're allowing 55% there. I don't expect that to continue, but I do think that they can be towards the top of the league, especially if they have Gasol and Brandon Wright healthy. However, 55% might be a little bit rich for them.
Yeah, I think that's right. Also, I want to look too at their turnovers. They forced 24 of those today, and they are in fact fifth in the league, forcing opponent turnovers on 17.7% of their possession. So I will allow you to revise your prediction, as I will do with mine. I predicted 42 wins for the Grizz and a playoff appearance, although I again had them right in the same range as Utah, the Clippers, and Portland. I'm going to actually stick pretty close to that. I think I would go with maybe 43 or 44, not more than that, especially because this Conley Achilles stuff is concerning. You had, I think, the under on their 37.5 wins. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, I actually had them at 37, so I was really close to that, but did have the under. I thought, you know, with injuries and Conley Gasol, and one actually interesting element of this, just before we get into all of it, is that Memphis, first of all, their starters haven't been dominant. Their starter net rating is middle of the pack, but they've actually, and I think this is just related to how they've been playing them, Conley and Gasol together only have a plus 0.9 net rating. So they've only outscored opponents by about 1.4 possessions. And so that's a little bit concerning, just because the bench play, if that doesn't continue, if they're not being buttressed by that, then that's going to be a big concern. So I said 37. I will revise it up, but I'm not going to revise it up much. I'm going to go with like maybe 38 or 39.
Wow. Okay. So you still would say they're not going to make playoffs. Yeah. You mentioned the starters, and they're starting two replacement level guys pretty much all year, Jarrell Martin and Andrew Harrison.
Yes, that's true.
You know, so that's a big reason, I think, why they've had some struggles as a starting unit, and why Conley and Gasol together, who often play with those starters, have not been as effective. They just don't have threats around them. How about Orlando? We've talked a lot about them. To expand on that a little bit, though, I mean, they're shooting, and again, I mean, didn't cool off tonight, 13 out of 29, that's 44.8%, and they're shooting right around that number for the season. But I said, just looking at their offense the other day, just doing some quick and dirty math live on the show, that essentially this is a good way to think about it. You know, just with the average NBA team probably taking around 33s a game, every 3 percentage points in 3-point percentage is worth about 3 points, essentially. So if they're shooting 6% better than the average, or what you might expect them to, that's about 6 points per game, essentially, that they're getting. And then you look on defense, and they're basically, opponents are shooting in the low 30s, so maybe 6 points worse than would be expected. So that's almost 12 points a game that they are getting just from what we might look at as aberrant 3-point percentage from what could be expected going forward.
Yeah, so the real challenge with them is not necessarily will they be able to sustain this. I think the answer to that we would both agree is no, is just how close is it? And that gets into the questions of just like how much of Aaron Gordon's performance so far has been real. Evan Fournier, I think, has had a nice start to the season. Vooch has been his best year as a pro, at least that I can remember. So you kind of have to reconcile all of that and the idea of that, you know, like, are they going to be as reliable getting back in transition? I think they can actually do okay there.
Yeah, they are 6-2. I mean, if you just look at the very surface, their net rating in non-garbage time, which Falk calculates, plus 9.4. They've beaten some good teams, Memphis now among them, the Spurs, they really throttled. So, but if they have a plus 9.4 net rating and 12 points of that net rating is basically due to luck so far, you know, where exactly does that leave you? Also a concern is just they are a horrendous rebounding team, 29th on both ends in rebounding, and again on defense, you know, 6th in e-field goal percentage defense. They do force a lot of turnovers, which is helping their transition game, but you know, they're not really getting shots at the rim on offense. They do at least get to the foul line at a somewhat average rate. So I guess now same question here. This is one where I think I actually convinced you to go lower, right? Because we forgot that their point differential was so much worse last year. I think it was only a 24 win point differential. And then I actually predicted more wins than you did. I had 31 for them and you had 29 after I convinced you to do that.
Well, that's interesting because my own records, I think I might have changed that after our podcast and moved it up because my records have it at 33.
Okay, so maybe, or I may have just put it in wrong.
Yeah, either way. But so I'll use my 33 because I think that's probably about where I was feeling at that. I'm not willing to go as crazy as 538 is right now. 538 has them at 48 wins right now, but I'll say 38 and I could easily see it being 43. You know, like they could be anywhere in that range and I wouldn't be surprised. We have to see if this can persist. But as you said, the luck element and, you know, banking 6 wins and playing the Bulls on Friday, that, you know, that's probably going to be banking a 7th win. I think they have a shot to do this. And what's going to be a definitive stretch for them, at least in the near term, is they have 2 4-game road trips before the end of this month. And so if they can go 500 on those, a lot of good teams on those trips, they can go even 500, then I'm going to be ready to say they're a playoff team.
Hilariously, we both predicted their best case scenario as 38 wins. It shows you how completely useless those predictions are, perhaps. Okay, we got a couple more teams we need to get to here. But first, this from Pro Flowers. They have the perfect gift for anyone excited about fall, a long-lasting bouquet in their favorite fall colors. In fact, in our new place, we have one sitting as the centerpiece on our new kitchen table right now. Looks great. We moved in 5 days ago. Looks as good as new. They give you all these instructions about exactly how to keep it fresh. They give you a little packet of plant food. They tell you, all right, this is when you cut off the stems, freshen it up. So if you're like me and you have no idea how flowers work, I mean, I'm normally one of those like evil cartoon characters where like if I just touch a pair of flowers or a set of flowers, they basically just like go dead immediately. I have whatever the opposite of a green thumb is, but it's easy enough even for me to keep them fresh, because if you get flowers for your significant other, they don't want to have to be responsible for keeping them fresh. That's your job, and Pro Flowers makes it really easy to do that. Their best-selling cinnamon cider roses, the ones that we have sitting on our table right now, are a great option for a birthday, an anniversary, any fall occasion, or go with one of the classics like 100 autumn blooms or a dozen autumn roses. You can't lose, because no matter which bouquet you send, my listeners can get 20% off of any of Pro Flowers' unique bouquets, $29 or more. They are guaranteed to stay fresh fresh for at least 7 days, and they are well on their way to doing that for me. I've gotten them previously. They've fulfilled that guarantee as well. So the way to get started with them, 20% off all bouquets of $29 or more. Go to proflowers.com. Use my code CAPSPACE at checkout. Easy to remember, of course. It's on our t-shirts. Proflowers.com, promo code CAPSPACE. Don't wait to make someone's day. All right, who else we got here?
Let's talk a little bit about the Detroit Pistons. I don't think we need to go into as much depth with them. Their trademark stretch so far was those wins on the road on back-to-back nights in LA against the Clippers and then in Oakland against the Warriors. And they have a 1.9 net rating, which is 14th. That's, you know, they're doing a nice job there. But the big question for me is just whether they will be able to sustain their offense, even though their offense hasn't been particularly dominant.
Yeah, they are the 16th best offense, but one of their fundamentals is awful. They never, ever, ever get to the foul line. Amazing for a team that once had Andre Drummond getting intentionally fouled. Now he's not even getting intentionally fouled. He's hitting more free throws, but he doesn't play with any force at all, really, at this point, which is a disappointment. You thought when he was drafted, he could be one of these guys who would sprint down the floor and transition, get his butt into guys, get a hard seal, and force you to foul him. And really, I think perhaps he was always a guy who kind of fancied himself more of a skill player anyway, but didn't really have any skills. And his post-up game has always been more finesse, despite not really having that much finesse. And then I'm sure this thing about not wanting to get fouled really reduced his physicality as well. Still remains a wonderful rebounder, of course, but he doesn't get to the line. No one else on this team really does either. And then they, while overall from three, they haven't shot it that well. A couple of guys, Tobias Harris shooting 44% on threes. He's looked a lot better. And he improves his three-pointer every year. So I'm not going to say that none of that's real, but he's not going to shoot 44%. And then Langston Galloway shooting 50% on threes and 57% from the field. He's always been one of these guys who's like a good bet to shoot better from three than two, which means you're not shooting very good from two. And Galloway's performance, Anthony Tolliver, though he's not shooting some amazing percentage, they've gotten some big runs with him in there. And so their bench net rating is one of the best in the league. Their starters, not quite as good. They do at least avoid making mistakes offensively. They're third in turnover avoidance. And that's an underrated way, if you're a bad offense, to at least A, help your defense out by not giving up fast breaks, and B, just making sure you get a shot up every single time. And they're pretty average on the offensive glass. I agree with you. This doesn't really feel like a top half of the league offense to me.
Well, when you look at what shots they're getting, especially relative to the league, it's just a slew of red flags. So they're shooting more mid-range shots than most teams. They're in the top 10, eighth in frequency there. They're 25th in shots at the rim. So not only are they failing to get to the free throw line, they're also not making those shots. They're also not shooting those and just not getting fouled. They're not doing either one of those. And then they're, you know, right around the middle of the pack in terms of three proportions. So when you look at that and you see a team that is still, I think they're around league average in terms of effective field goal percentage right now, that's a big concern, because it's hard to, you know, to kind of break some of those walls to build efficient offense. Actually, they're 20th in effective field goal percentage offense right now. So to me, that looks like a warning sign in terms of how they're going to be on that end. But defensively, they've been sound, and I could see them actually being a little bit better on that end than they've been so far.
Yeah, and Avery Bradley, despite the fact that we've been higher on KCP than some, Avery Bradley has looked better defensively, perhaps a more reliable shooter, if not a more frequent shooter than KCP as well. And, you know, they can have a pretty solid defense on this team. Stan is a pretty good defensive coach. So, you know, I think they're going to settle in kind of around where we thought. I think I had them with 39 wins. You know, I might revise that upward a game or two just because of the nice wins that they have banked so far. And I was very impressed with their defense. I mean, if the Warriors are like, oh, man, we had so many turnovers, we're so careless, blah, 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 in that game that they lost to the Pistons. But, like, the Pistons created a lot of those with their pressure. They're blitzing pick and rolls hard. They're bringing another guy up, old-school Miami Heat style, and intercepting passes. And Avery Bradley, of course, has always been a thorn in the side of some of those Warriors guards. So they do have more activity. You know, I think they're looking like a playoff team. I don't think they're looking like a team that's going to get to, you know, 50 wins necessarily, or maybe even 45. But, you know, I mean, I would say maybe 40, 41, just because of the wins they've banked, but they're kind of right on track with where I thought they'd be. And it was good to see at least that Reggie Jackson looks like, you know, a real NBA point guard again.
He does, and that's an important element of their team moving forward, because if they have productive minutes, or at least largely productive minutes from him and from Ish Smith, then that gives them a base offensively to at least reach the level that they need to with their defense. Something else that I like about what the Pistons have done so far is that they only have one what I would consider a bad loss so far, because their other ones were that close game against Washington early in the year, which I think we both watched, and then they lost to the Sixers once. But the problem is that their bad loss was their most recent game. It was when they got housed by the Lakers in one that reminded me, because that was the only game on in its time slot, of just kind of what their offense can be when it's not getting this reliability. They only shot 3 free throws in that entire game. They were shot 30% from 3, and so they will have those stinker nights. It's kind of like maybe some of those Memphis teams in that way, where they could maybe eventually have a misleading point differential just because they'll have some of those bad games. But yeah, so I said 38, I'll go to 40, but I'm not sure, you know, like I in a week or two I could totally be seeing myself say I believe in the Magic more than I believe in them.
Yeah, that wouldn't shock me. The Magic certainly seem to have more upside than this Pistons squad. Boston, we mentioned they're 6-1 since opening night, 6-2 overall. Coming into tonight, 10.4 net rating in non-garbage time. That is second in the NBA. It has been nearly entirely on the strength of the number one defense in the NBA, long a punching bag for other teams on the defensive glass. They are 7th in defensive rebound percentage. That is great progress for them. But most of what has contributed to this number one defense is opponents missing shots.
And that is always a massive concern. I mean, so they are in many ways you don't want.
Missing shots at a rate less than you'd or more than you would expect from certain areas is really, I think, more what it is. I mean, obviously the name of the game is to make opponents miss shots, but usually what you do is you force them to take more shots from areas where it's tougher to hit shots.
And they are doing some of that. I mean, they're allowing only 27% of their opponent's shots are coming from three, but only 31% of those are going in. So you have a positive and a negative running together. The big concern for me is their defensive rebounding has been good, but teams have been getting shots at the rim a lot against them. 36.3% is a lot of them, and they're middle of the road in terms of slowing those down. That's something that could become a bigger problem. And they've been good over the last couple of years, not as good last year as other ones in terms of forcing turnovers. But I'm a little bit concerned that the foul rate could come back to bite them. Just a couple of different things. When you're giving up that many shots at the rim, it feels like it's not a house of cards, because I think their other fundamentals are strong, but that it's the type of thing that could get a little bit worse as this moves on, especially if teams start making closer to league average from three.
Yeah, and it mentioned too that they're allowing a lot of shots at the rim. They're also allowing very few points per possession in transition, not allowing a ton of transition chances necessarily, but when teams do get out in transition, they are scoring extremely poorly. That could be liable to regress. I will say, though, certainly never thought that Kyrie Irving would ever have a 92.6 defensive rating for like any 6-game stretch of his career, or 8-game stretch,
and
I should say.
We talked about this a little bit before the season, but I think it's been actualized even earlier than I anticipated, of the idea that his weaknesses defensively are something that Boston is actually better equipped to handle, because now that they have all these different forwards that are about the same size, they can switch so much, and that's kind of what they want to do anyway. So it's not like Cleveland, where they would get forced into these bad situations, because Boston's personnel just fits that better.
Yeah, that's right. And also they just have a better culture in terms of their coaching, I think, which is crazy to think about. Al Horford is certainly a solid leader and teammate, but you know, I do think that some of Cleveland's struggles, and we'll of course talk about them when we do Time to Panic, some of Cleveland's struggles are due to not really having the defensive culture. And frankly, I mean, I don't know how much you want to say that this was David Black, because certainly all of the reporting on the ground there was, you know, no one was listening to him. And maybe it was just the fact that Lou plays more offensive guys and Blatt maybe defaulted towards more playing at two bigs and more defensive guys. But like, Cleveland actually defended under David Blatt, and ever since Lou took over, they have really had pretty bad defense with the exception of that 2016 finals series.
On the offensive end, Jason Tatum is shooting about 3 threes a game and making 50% of those. I do not expect that to continue. Jaylen Brown's up to 41% this year. Those two will probably tone down, but they have a lot of other guys that, you know, that are towards the bottom end. Smart's at 28. You'd love to see that a little higher, though it's not like it has been earlier in his career. And then Kyrie and Rozier are more in the mid-30s.
All right. Anything else you want to add here, or shall we pack it in?
I think that's about it.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about our sponsor, Pro Flowers. Use that cap space code to get 20% off all bouquets of $29 or more at proflowers.com. And we'll be back to conclude the week tomorrow evening. Also, hoping 95% sure, as long as DirecTV keeps their appointment and is actually able to install my service tomorrow, that we will have the Twitter NBA show as well. So be sure to check that out via my Twitter feed at Nate Duncan NBA. Talk to you all tomorrow.